You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
We're very pleased today to have a University of Minnesota graduate with us, Wendy Webb. She grew up in Minneapolis and has been a journalist here for nearly two decades, writing for most of the major publications in the region. Currently, she lives in Duluth with her spouse, photographer Steve Burmeister, and her son, Ben. And she's at work on her next novel. We're very pleased to have her here today to discuss The Tale of Halcyon Crane. Please welcome Wendy Webb.
Hi, thank you guys for coming. I really do appreciate it. It's just really fun for me to be back here at the U of M. I was just here this summer to take my son on a tour of the campus. He wants to attend the U in the fall. And so I was just telling them that I think I've finally impressed him, because I've been on a book tour all summer long, and you know, it's been an on-air book club, and it's got a lot of acclaim, and it's been on the bestseller list. He doesn't care about that. But he was really impressed when he learned that I was coming down here. So I thought, oh, great, okay, finally impressed the boy. And what I thought I'd do, I'd read, and at these events, I usually just read the first chapter. The story is about a woman who realizes one otherwise ordinary day that everything that she ever knew about her life was a lie. And the story takes place as she's trying to find the truth about who she is, who her family is, and all that good stuff. There's a little murder, a little betrayal, family secrets, and a few ghosts involved, too. So, chapter one starts. I was the only passenger on the ferry crossing to Grand Manitou Island. As I stood on deck, holding tight to the railing while we dipped and tumbled on the green, roiling waves, I understood why tourist season grinds to a halt when the November winds blow. I was called to the tiny island in the middle of the Great Lakes by a dead woman. I traveled there at an unwelcoming time of year to learn the story of her life, hoping to discover my own story as well. A few whitecaps and swells wouldn't keep me away. A summons from the dead is a strange way to begin a tale, but as I've since learned, it's really no stranger than any other story in my family. As it turns out, I come from a long line of people who hover on the edge of reality. My family history isn't merely a chronicle of births and deaths and weddings and accomplishments, though it includes those things. No, the stories of my relatives sound more like fairy tales, Grimm's, unfortunately, with witches, hauntings, and malevolence, all wrapped up in regrettable and sometimes bloody mishaps. Until recently, I knew nothing of this. Growing up, I had an altogether different notion of who I was and where I came from. Then the truth began to reveal itself, as it always does. Truth seeks the light of day, needs it, just like we need air. So it finds ways to seep out of the sturdiest, most skillfully hidden boxes, even those buried deeply in the hearts of the dead. My truth took its first breath one foggy autumn morning, nearly 1,000 miles away from where I stood on the tossing ferry. That particular day didn't begin with anything out of the ordinary. Isn't that always the way? Life is thrown into chaos while you're making your way through mundane, everyday tasks. An accident on the way to the grocery store takes your beloved. A heart attack interrupts a lazy Sunday morning. Or in my case, life-altering news arrives with the morning mail. I woke in my little bungalow overlooking Puget Sound and lay in bed a while, listening to the barking of the seals. Then I pulled on a sweatsuit and sneakers and headed outside for my usual morning walk. I had already crossed the street and started up the hill before I noticed the fog settling in, dulling the edges of the world around me. Some people find the sound of a foghorn romantic, evoking images of travel to faraway places with strange-sounding names. But I've never liked the fog. It obscures reality with what seems to be a sinister intent, erasing all that's not within arm's reach. Anything could be out there, beyond. I knew it was silly being unnerved by fog in a seaside town, so I continued to walk on my usual route, listening to the tinkling of the wind chimes, tubular bells, that were hanging from the eaves of various houses along the way. I can't explain why. Did I sense what was coming? But the back of my neck began to tingle with 1,000 tiny pinpricks. I paused, holding my breath, dread seeping off the cold pavement into the bottoms of my feet and working its way up my legs. Then something convinced me to hurry home, and I arrived at my door just in time to see the mailman materialize out of the fog. "Pea soup," he said, shaking his head as he handed me a stack of mail. "You be careful out there, Scooter," I smiled at him. "I couldn't see you until you were on my front step." "Don't you worry about me, Miss James. I'm old friends with this fog." I watched him disappear into the whiteness and took the mail inside, where hot coffee was waiting, and I poured myself a cup as I sorted through the stack. Along with the usual assortment of letters, bills, and catalogs, was a large manila envelope labeled Archer and Son, Attorneys at Law. I noticed the postmark, Grand Manitou Island, a popular tourist destination on one of the Great Lakes, halfway across the country from my home. I sat at my kitchen table sipping coffee, turning the envelope over and over in my hands. What was this about? What did this lawyer want with me? Finally, I took a deep breath and tore it open to face whatever it contained. I found two letters inside. One bore my name and address handwritten on the front of a thick, creamy envelope, the back flap sealed with crimson wax. It was old-fashioned and lovely, reminding me of an invitation from another place and time. As it turned out, that's exactly what it was. The other was a white, business-sized, no-nonsense envelope. I opened that one first. "Dear Miss James, it is with deep regret that I inform you of Madeline Crane's death. I'm Miss Crane's attorney and the executor of her will. Please contact me at your earliest convenience. Respectfully yours, William Archer, attorney at law." Madeline Crane. The name sounded familiar, but I couldn't quite place it. Why did this lawyer regret to inform me of her death? A feeling of undefined, unexplainable apprehension began to cling to me as I picked up the second letter. Why was my heart pounding so? Why were my hands shaking? I broke the seal on the back of the envelope, unfolded the letter, and began reading. It was dated almost 1 month ago. "Dear Hallie, 30 years ago, my daughter and my husband were killed in a boating accident near our island home. Imagine my surprise to find that they, you and your father, are very much alive. I don't quite know how to continue this letter. What do I say to my only child for whom I have grieved all of these years? I'll start here. When I learned that you were alive, I was as stunned as you must be now. I had the impulse to pick up the phone and call you immediately, but then it hit me. I couldn't do that. I had no idea what you had been told. Did you believe I was dead? Did you believe I had abandoned you? Your father could have told you anything. But now you're a grown woman. If you had any inkling I was alive, you would have found a way to contact me. I came to the conclusion that you and I must have been told the same lie, each believing the other was dead. We were both deceived. How does a mother rise from the dead and enter her child's life? I thought of coming to see you, but simply showing up on your doorstep did not seem wise. A letter seemed like the gentlest way to turn your world upside down. I know you must have many questions, as do I. I'll tell you a little bit about myself now, but really, can one sum up a lifetime in a few words? My name is Madeline Crane. I still live in the house where you were born on Grand Manitou Island. You may recognize my name. I'm a photographer. You may have seen my work in various magazines. I imagine you grew up grieving for me, wishing to have a mother to shepherd you through the heaven that is childhood and the purgatory that is adolescence. I'm so sorry that I was not there for you. But, Hallie, every time you wished for a mother's love, you had it. I loved you before you were born. I loved you during the empty years when I thought you were dead. And I love you now. That will never change. Although you didn't know it, you've always had a mother who loved you more than anything. I know you must be wondering what to think about this, a letter from a stranger who's alleging to be your mother. Is it true? I'm sure it flies in the face of everything you've believed about your life for the past 30 years. I'm sorry to create such a tempest for you. Believe me, I considered staying dead to spare you this confusion. But I concluded that the truth, no matter how painful, must be told. By way of authentication, please look at the photograph I'm enclosing. It's you and your father a few days before you died. I took it myself. I also offer this, an invitation. Come back to Grand Manitou Island. So much time has been wasted already. Love from your mother, Madeline Crane. The photograph fluttered out as I let the letter drop to the ground. It was a small, square, black and white print with a white border. I saw a little girl with a strange sheen in her eyes. Was it me? It certainly looked like me, but I couldn't really be sure. It might have been any dark-haired girl. But there was no mistaking my father. Younger, thinner, with more hair, but unquestionably him. This was the man who had put me to bed and dried my tears and took me ice skating. I had no doubt. I picked up Madeline Crane's letter and read the words over and over again until they blurred into meaningless symbols. I don't know how long I sat there, staring at it. A letter from a ghost. Thank you. Well, so that's how it starts. And when I started doing these readings earlier this summer, I was talking to another author about, you know, what to do and what to say to people. And she told me to kind of give people who come a little bit something different than they would get in the book. And so I have a little story about how I started to write this book and how it relates to the first chapter. Now, I started to write this a few years ago, and when my son was still young enough to allow me to walk him to school. So I'd start every day, we'd hitch up our dog. We had a big 130-pound Malamute at the time. And so we'd hitch up our dog and I'd walk him to school, and then I would continue on and get my morning walk in every morning, and the dog appreciated it, and so did I. And as it happens, you know, when you're walking around your neighborhood, a lot of times you run into the same people. And so I was walking along this particular morning, and it was very, very foggy. I don't know if you know anything about Duluth, but it's a very foggy town. And all of a sudden, this fog just closed in around me, and I could hardly see anything. And so we're kind of walking along, and I could hear the wind chimes just like the story started. And out of the fog came a person that I sort of recognized. It was a woman that I'd seen over and over again on my walks, but she annoyed me because she would never say hello. And you know, here in the Midwest, we are friendly. We say hello to people when they pass, but she never would. I was would try to get her to say hello, and she'd just kind of walk on and never even look at me. So I was thinking, gee, you know, maybe she's autistic, or maybe she's just socially very shy or whatever. And but this morning she came, and I was kind of getting ready. I was thinking, okay, I'm going to get her to say hello this morning. But I didn't get a chance to do that, because as she passed, she turned to me, looked me right in the face, and said, "Something's coming," and then just walked on. And I'm thinking, you know, she's never spoken a word to me. Then she says this cryptic thing, walks on, disappears into the fog, and I just sort of freaked out a little bit. You know, as I wrote in the first chapter, fear was just kind of seeping up from the sidewalk into my feet and body. And by the time I got home, I had worked myself into a frenzy, thinking, well, what's coming? Well, something obviously is coming. And I had myself convinced I was going to get bad news in the mail. Well, I didn't get anything in the mail. But what I did get was an idea for a novel, thinking, what if, you know, what could come in the mail that would just completely turn my world upside down? And that's how I started to write it. So that's that story. Does anybody have any questions about the novel or publishing or anything?
She said you were a journalist, but have you always written fiction as well, or was this your first attempt?
This is my first published novel, but I wrote three before this one got published. And this is a story I tell over and over at these readings also. The persistent get published. And really, you know, my first novel I wrote, well, it was 7-8 years ago now, And we got an agent. I wrote it with a co-author. We got an agent right away, and we got a book deal right away with a major publisher. And we were thinking, gee, I thought this was supposed to be hard. Well, obviously, we're really, really good. It's hard for others. It's not hard for us. Well, then September 11th happened. The publishing world was in chaos. Our editor got fired. Several people got fired. And our manuscript just sat and sat and sat for almost a year and a half. Finally, we got the rights back, got another agent. But Harry Potter had burst on the scene. This was a young adult, kind of a time travel fantasy. And that market was just flooded. So there we were. We thought we had everything. Then we had nothing. In the meantime, I was writing another story, though. And my agent loved that one. That one didn't sell. I wrote another one. That one didn't sell. And finally, I wrote this one. And my message through all this, I know a guy, he's a best-selling author now. He wrote 9 novels before his 10th one was published. And that was kind of my way of approaching it, too. I've been a writer all my life. I knew I had the talent to write a novel that would get published, but maybe I just hadn't found the right story. And so I was really determined I was going to keep at this until I was 90. You know, I really wanted this to happen. And it did. So I'm lucky that way. Anybody else have any?
Were your other adult novels the same genre?
Yeah.
And is your next one the same, or are you going into a different?
No, the next one is sort of the same. It's what I found that I really love is I love a Great Lakes setting because there's so much kind of lore and mystery and kind of magic to be called around the Great Lakes. And as I've been touring around the Great Lakes this summer at bookstores, the bookstore owners and the booksellers are so happy that I've written about this area because not a whole lot of people are. And so I thought, oh, well, I can do that. And so the next story is set on Lake Superior, and the lake is a more major character than it is in this book. But if you know anything about Lake Superior lore, I've been living up in Duluth now for about 10 years, and the people there kind of think of the lake almost as a living thing. They'll call it Mother Superior. And, you know, the lake's angry today. The lake, you know, is cooling us off today. They really think of it as a being. And it is in my next book. It's a mystery and in the same genre as this. But that is, now I feel like I'm babbling, but that is one of the other things that I've learned in that once you have success in one genre, stay in it. Because you have, you know, I have thousands and thousands of people who love this book and they're waiting for the next one. So I want to write something that is going to please them instead of, you know, departing and writing a whole different type of book. So I'm glad I had success with this because I love this genre.
Will you go back, and now that you're well-known and published, will you go back with any of your other works and try and get them published again?
Yeah, I think I will. After the next book, I think I'm going to go back to the one I wrote previous to this because it is in the same genre. The first adult one that I wrote is just a little bit different. It's a little more out there. And so we'll wait, you know, until I've been on the New York Times bestseller list for a while, and then maybe put that one out. But this other author that I know that wrote the 9 novels before the 10th one got published, he didn't publish any of those 9 until he got to be a really famous author. And then he put them on, self-published them as ebooks on Amazon. And he's made a lot of money doing that. J.A. Conrath, he writes, and this is a genre that I don't really read. I just struck up a friendship with him. He writes horror, real scary murder mysteries. And they're a little too scary for me.
Does she have anything to do with your cover art, or were you given that by your publisher?
I was given this by the publisher, but I had full control over what I wanted, which is kind of unusual. I was real happy about that because I don't care what they say. I buy books based on the cover. And I know if I'm going to like a book, or more importantly, if I'm not going to like a book by the way the cover looks. And so I was really scared to see the cover, and I saw it and I absolutely loved it. And my agent and I kind of went back and forth. She had a few things she wanted changed. She said, no, you got to make her name bigger. So my parents were happy about that. But I think it turned out great. Thanks. And the other thing I get asked all the time is how come it came out in paperback instead of hardcover? And I actually think it was a stroke of genius. At first, when they said, we want to publish you in paperback, I thought, I want a hardcover book. But it's geared toward reading groups, and it has reading group questions in the back, and it has just gone like wildfire with reading groups. I was at this, just one example, I was at a bookstore in suburban Milwaukee, and they have 150 reading groups registered with that bookstore. All of them have this on their list to read. And reading groups read paperbacks. They don't read hardcovers for the most part. So I was really grateful that it did come out in paperback. So I think publishing is changing, though. I think we'll see more and more paperbacks.
Nice to have that reading group guide, frankly.
It is. I just, and I've had lots of reading groups that I've gone and spoken to. Usually, when I do an appearance at a bookstore, then I'll kind of dovetail it with a reading group or two or three. And that really, it makes it fun. They've got really great questions. And I've learned a lot about my own book by listening to the questions that reading groups have. And oftentimes, they'll bring up stuff that I never even intended. And, I call it kind of the English major factor. It's like, these people are really smart, and they're finding things in the book that I hadn't intended, but I always take credit for. Like, I remember this one, not giving anything away, but when Hallie was born, she was blind. And this one woman said, you have a lot of scenes with fog in it in the book, and I noticed that Hallie was blind, she was born. Now, is the fog a metaphor for not being able to see? And I said, yeah. Yes, it was. You picked up on that, which, of course, I hadn't even intended. But so that's been really neat for me.
What's your best book tour story?
Oh, I have had such great experience, especially in independent bookstores all around the Great Lakes. The biggest appearance, I was an on-air book club pick for a TV show in Green Bay. I was also one down here earlier in the spring. But I got there to Green Bay, and, it was this bookstore in this kind of strip mall, and I thought, oh, gee, I wonder if anybody's going to be here. And my cousin, who lives in the area, was kind of milling around outside, and I said, gee, and there was a space right to park right out front, and I thought, oh, gosh, I hope a few people came. And I said, gee, Ron, is anybody in there? And he went, yeah. And I got in, and there was probably 250 people there. They kept having to go get more chairs. There was a restaurant next door who brought chairs, and it was really neat. The line at the end, I felt like John Grisham. And another neat, the book is set on a fictionalized version of Mackinac Island, which I don't know if anybody has ever been to Mackinac Island, but it's such a beautiful, lovely, romantic place. There's no cars. You go everywhere in horse and carriage. And the buildings are beautiful. The hotels are from the turn of the century. But it's also a little creepy. Every hotel has a ghost story. And we've vacationed there several times. And so I knew if I was going to write a ghost story, I'd want to set it there. And so when I first got the book deal, I got a call from the owner of the independent bookstore on Mackinac Island. And she said, we'd like to do a big event for you this summer here on the island. I said, sure. So she got back to me with the date, and it happened to be June 26th. And that date is very significant for me. I dedicate the book to my brother, and his birthday was June 20. He passed away a few years ago. His birthday is June 26th. and my husband's father passed away on June 26th, 30 years ago. And to be going back to the place that inspired my first novel and to do a big event on that particular day, I just knew we were going to have some disembodied spirits there. And that was another really big event. And the people just kept coming and coming and coming. And I was really grateful. So that was one of the neatest experiences, too.
Do you love the movie Somewhere in Time?
Yes. And going there, you can really see why whoever wrote that story would write a time travel story. Because that's what you feel like when you're on Mackinac Island. You feel like you've gone back in time. And one of the neatest and also the eeriest things about it is we don't really realize what our life consists of in terms of like street noise. You know, you're walking downtown and you hear buses, you hear cars, you hear radios, you hear all this stuff, and you just kind of tune it out. But then when you get to a place that doesn't have that, and the only thing it has is the clop, 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 clop of the horses' hoofs, it's almost like it's mesmerizing to just listen to the street noise, and it's just a really cool place. Well, are you guys interested in publishing, or are you just interested in writing, or just wanted to hear about a ghost story, or I'm just wondering.
I just wanted to hear about your book.
Well, great. Well, thank you all so much for coming. If you want me to sign books, I'll be happy to. And it was really fun being back at Kauffman Union.
Thank you.
Thank you.